welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news and healthcare, science, policy, well, all things around science and medicine in the news, and your questions via email or via phone calls. It's another hour of Ask Dr. Dawn. Before I go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, I have some lovely emails. It was a good week for that. But before we roll out, I just have to throw out the baseball on the health policy issues, because this one, an article in the San Jose Mercury News a couple of days ago, caught my eye. With all the back and forth about healthcare funding reform, I think one of the things that has been brought to the forefront is the idea that some of these regulations are kind of a good idea, like letting kids who are under 26 and don't have jobs yet that cover health insurance get on their parents' policies, so at least they're covered. Good idea. Having people who have pre-existing conditions be able to get health insurance, particularly children with cancer. Yeah, good idea. Limiting these sort of lifetime caps on all payments so that, you know, you get this expensive disease, but we only have to cover you up to the first million. After that, you're on your own. Good idea. Okay, bad idea? Well, everybody seems to be arguing about the mandate. I'm not going to touch that one. That's been covered a lot. And I'm going to mention something else, though. That which is not forbidden is permitted. And so despite all of the protections built into the healthcare financing law, it's really easy to get around that if you're smart and sleazy. And unfortunately, a lot of such people apparently work for health insurance companies. You should read the fine print on your latest policies, because you will find that things have changed. For example, since you can't limit coverage or ultimate numbers of dollars that can be spent, you can limit numbers of visits. And this article discusses a woman who had breast cancer in 2009, and she had COBRA coverage through her employer. And when that ran out, she bought health insurance for a individual policy, and she found one with a monthly premium of $254, which, if you think about that for a second, that's suspiciously low for a woman with a past medical history of breast cancer. I'd expect something more like $2,000 a month for her. So she has been going to her oncologist breast surgeon and underwent breast reconstruction surgery over the summer. And she noticed that she was getting, after a few months, she noticed she was getting billed for doctor's visits. Well, then she went and read the fine print in the policy, and it turns out her policy pays for two doctor visits a year. That's right, two doctor visits a year. There's unlimited reimbursement for those two visits, but she can only go twice. Well, that doesn't actually work when you have breast cancer and are getting treatment for it, but it doesn't really work for anybody. Like I said, read the fine print. This is apparently the sort of thing that is permitted under the new law. We've entered into the age, and if the bill gets defanged in Congress, and then it'll be even worse. But we've entered into the age of predatory insurance. We've had predatory credit cards, and we've had predatory lending on your house. Now we're going to have predatory insurance practices. Get out the magnifying glass, friends, and read the fine print. First, some emails. This from Michelle in Louisiana. Dear Dawn, there's an easy rule for buying organic versus non-organic food. If it has an outer covering that you're going to eat, especially if it has a large, thin surface area through which pesticides might diffuse, don't eat it because you can't wash the pesticides off. If it's to be peeled, then you can buy non-organic. That's a good rule, although there are a couple of exceptions. And so I think trying to remember this when you're at the supermarket has really been a big difficulty for me. My husband just gave me an app for my Droid phone that actually is a list of these things, and that's useful. But I think the thin skin rule is a good one, and it works most of the time. So any kind of greens, lettuce, salad greens, anything like that would count as thin skin. The exceptions are cabbage, which, of course, the the outer leaves are peeled off, so that's one of the reasons. Eggplant and asparagus and sweet potatoes. So those are all things where you might eat the skin. You certainly eat the skin on asparagus and eggplant, and yet those are clean and you don't need to buy organic. So with a little bit of modification, Michelle's rules are clear. Something I just learned in researching for this was that the absolute worst thing to buy is celery. You have to get organic celery. Celery apparently has the highest pesticide content of any of the common fruits and vegetables sold. Apples and pears are also big problems. Pears in particular should buy organic because they use a lot of pesticides. Pears are very vulnerable. So some of it has to do with the vulnerability of the plant. And I was pleased to learn that I don't have to buy organic asparagus because asparagus is expensive enough as it is. Lynette in Ben Lomond. I have a friend who was older and got engaged to a widower. He gave her human papillomavirus and she had to have surgery because of it. She left him. The doctor told her there's no test for HPV in men. Is that true? If so, shouldn't all dating women, young and old, get the vaccine? Thanks for clarity on this. I'm older and single and trying to decide about dating again. Well, Lynette, this is an excellent question. And when surveys are done looking at HPV prevalence through like blood tests to tell, you know, do you have antibodies, thus presumably exposure and possibly you could shed virus, about a third of the sexually active population of both sexes comes up positive for antibodies to HPV. That means if you are a serial monogamist or dating and having sex with the people you date, you have a very good chance of being exposed to HPV. And it's hard to quantify exactly what that risk is. Now, there is a test for it in men. It's the blood test, but it doesn't tell us whether the man is contagious or not. And we don't have a good test for swabbing the penis or the male urethra to tell us whether or not the man is shedding virus. Particularly the viruses that are associated with cervical cancer don't give visible lesions in men. They just sit there and distribute the virus without suffering from any adverse sequelae themselves. The occasional and very rare case of penis cancer aside, mostly HPV is benign in men. So what do we do? Well, we could vaccinate all women who are sexually active, and eventually, as a society, we'll get there. The reason that the vaccine isn't offered is, well, it's actually a good question. It's expensive. It's about $600 to get fully vaccinated. And when this came out, it was approved for a certain subgroup of women. And effectively, that was the group that stood to benefit the most, the women who have not yet been infected with HPV. And who are young and either not sexually active yet or haven't had enough encounters to have contracted the viruses. Should it be given to other women, older women? Well, I think it's a matter of if you want to buy it, you could probably get it from a doctor, but it certainly is not going to be covered by your insurance. And as I mentioned, it's a pretty pricey vaccine. As a society, we have to decide risk-benefit, and risk is low on this, but benefit, cost-benefit becomes really key, and I think they've made a pretty good decision about how to distribute it. In the long run, I know many doctors are starting to vaccinate males. That's controversial, but it does make sense, particularly in bisexual or gay males, to vaccinate for this virus. Whether we would eventually eradicate cervical cancer, or most cases of cervical cancer, with some kind of vaccine, some different vaccine than the ones we've got, because they aren't broad enough, but it's kind of a dream for the future. Maybe in a century, we'll be able to do that. But I think in the short run, you're out there and it's part of the risk you take for being sexually active. Your friend getting surgery because she got HPV, I have a little trouble with the time curve on that. I think she might have actually gotten HPV years before and eventually that came up and she needed surgery. I doubt that you would get it quickly and need to have surgery, but it's possible that there is. This may be a false correlation, however, on her part. And I'm sorry that she broke up with him, because if something's present in 30% of the population, it's hard to blame anybody for it, in my opinion. Dana in Santa Cruz writes, what detox diet do you recommend for someone with pretty serious osteoarthritis? I eat carefully already, work out, do yoga, qigong, walk, see an acupuncturist regularly, but I think I get more pain relief if I would do a detox diet and then continue from there. Oh yes, I'm 63 and have significant pain and arthritis in wrists, knees, and one hip. Well, Dana, the first thing I would say for detox diet is that you should be on an anti-inflammatory diet to start with. And an anti-inflammatory diet is effectively a diet that is low in saturated fat and particularly low in omega-6 fatty acids. So that means no margarine, limit the cheese, lots of fish, lots of omega-3 fatty acids like flaxseed oil, trying to be as anti-inflammatory as possible with respect to the substrate that you consume that your body is going to turn into prostaglandins. The second aspect of diet for someone who suffers from arthritis is to use foods in the turmeric and curcumin family. These are things like curry and turmeric. The next one is onions and garlic, which contain sulfur compounds that are anti-inflammatory. Now, the elimination diet, which is the detox diet you're referring to, is a diet that's high in vegetable protein. It may, in fact, completely restrict meat, although that's variable. And it restricts corn, wheat, soy, peanuts, oranges, and dairy. And also those extra food groups that we all know and love, coffee and chocolate. So that's what I would suggest. A detox diet typically is also accompanied with the use of liver support herbs such as silymarin, and it's important to do it with adequate fluid. I can't stress that enough. Whenever you're trying to do any kind of a cleanse, adequate fluid is important. I do not encourage the use of colon cleansers or other purges. I think the concept of purges goes back to the Middle Ages, and that's really where it belongs. I have not seen any convincing data that purging the colon with strong cathartic agents works any better than just the gentle sort of elimination that comes from lots of fluid and lots of fiber. I wanted to read this email from Hal in Santa Cruz. Skin cell shedding and indoor air quality. Don, I was very interested in your comments about skin cell sloughing. One of my colleagues, Charles Weschler, has been looking at the squalene compounds in shed skin cells and estimates they're about 1% by mass. These compounds have very low vapor pressures, making them similar to the semi-volatile organic compounds that we bring home in plastic. Inevitably, they end up coating every surface of our home, like most of the volatile organic compounds we bring into our homes in plastics, fire retardants, and pesticides. These compounds then become reservoirs for more volatile compounds as well as for dust. Thus, all the surfaces of our home or any other human-occupied buildings end up becoming historical archives for our past chemical relationships, especially those involving the less volatile compounds. You may be thinking that you're looking at glass in your window, but you're actually looking through this coating on the glass. You mentioned the odor characteristics of our home. These are, in fact, our individual odor prints or that of our family. Interestingly enough, this chemical coating on all surfaces of our homes can also serve to either nourish or discourage the growth of fungi and perhaps bacteria. So we have this complex dynamic with a certain long-term stability that is very fundamental to our health and well-being. I'm looking into these relationships in the indoor environment and our microbiome under a Sloan Foundation grant, which is intended to link the indoor environmental scientists with the microbial ecologists using new fast genomic identification tools to characterize the microbial ecology of the indoor environment. He then goes on to quote an article by Lizzie Burchin in the November 25th issue of Nature about the complexity of this environment and the surfaces of the inside and outside of our bodies and homes, starting to frame everything as one giant big system with its own internal cycles, a type of thinking I feel that we are really entering into in medicine. We're finally starting to think environmentally and systems-wide, functional medicine being the forefront of that, but you're also starting to see systems-based medicine discussed in things like the New England Journal of Medicine. It's really very exciting. And now, as Hal points out, with these genomic tools, we're really going to be able to characterize things. And with our computers, we may actually be able to take a stab at understanding these highly complex systems. Let's go to our first caller, and that's Francis in Carmel. Hello, Francis.
Hello, Dr. Don.
Hi.
Thank you so much for your very good program. That was a very intriguing thing you read there about our internal environment. It almost sounds like we needn't be so super clean about the house inside, because we may be protected by our dust.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And I really look forward to hearing what Hal finds out in his research. And I'm definitely going to pull that article. It was the November 25th issue of Nature. Lizzie Buchen, B-U-C-H-E-N. So you should be able to find it that way.
Very good. I had a question concerning this new product called the Mega Red Omega 3 Krill Oil.
Uh-huh.
I'm a cardiac arrest survivor of 12 years, and I take fish oil. I used to take fish oil each morning with the breakfast and each evening with supper. But then I got more and more difficult to swallow those hammer knocker pills. Then I read about krill oil, that it's more intense and the pills are smaller, and one pill a day is good as two pills of fish oil. So I'm switching to krill oil, and I'm wondering if you are aware of that product and whether you can support that change.
I am aware of the product, and I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I'm not enthusiastic about your making the switch. And the reason has to do with the content, the type of omega-3 fatty acid that the krill oil contains is primarily dexahexaenoic acid, which is DHA. And the DHA is fabulous for your brain, and it's a good anti-inflammatory oil, but it isn't as beneficial for the heart, and that's where you need to be placing your emphasis. The better of the two common omega-3s that we look at is the EPA, which is eicosapentaenoic acid. That one is more effective and seems to have better stabilization properties for arrhythmias, and that's what your risk is an acute arrhythmia. You've already had one. So I would say finding a liquid oil, and many of the companies that make fish oil make a liquid version that is not fishy tasting. I use one by a local company here called Nordic Naturals, and I actually add it to my health shake in the morning. It's so neutral that there's no fish taste at all, and it's faintly lemony. You could put it on salad in a salad dressing. That would also be a good way to take it.
And it's called Nordic Naturals.
Nordic Naturals. They make several different ones. I would look at their website and see which liquid fish oil contains the most EPA and shoot for about 2,000 milligrams of EPA. That's a lot, but that's the dose that's been shown in clinical trials to reduce arrhythmias and to be equivalent to using Lipitor in terms of event rates. There was one study, and there's only one, where anyone put a statin up against high-dose fish oil, and they tied, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, I'm taking a statin as well.
And I think you should. You're a high-risk individual. I'm not discouraging that, but I would say that the krill oil may not be as effective as a fish oil that contains more EPA, and I don't think you should make that switch.
Well, very good. Thank you so much.
If you don't mind, before you go, Francis, I have a question for you.
Sure.
There's been a lot in the news lately about CPR, and this year somebody published a study showing that just pushing on the chest and not trying to breathe for people, it doubled the rate of survival because the bystanders out there in the community are willing to push on your chest, but they don't want to do mouth-to-mouth respiration.
Right.
And so just getting someone to push on your chest soon is the best thing for survival. So they switched in Arizona, and they did a big study about the switch, and it was pretty convincing. And just recently, a new form of CPR where they actually put a suction cup on your chest and suck you open. So they push down and pull up, and that moves more blood through. I'm wondering about the circumstances of your arrest. Were you in the community when it happened?
I was playing tennis, and there was a football game going on nearby. And when I fell down on the court, somebody from the football game noticed me, and a lady who had 13 years of training in CPR, pretty young lady, came over and gave me mouth-to-mouth and compressions for 16 minutes all by herself. And then a team joined her from the rescue people, and they continued for another 15 minutes until a good working defibrillator came along.
Wow, that is an amazing story. And well, congratulations. I hope you bought her some flowers, that lady who saved your life.
And they all got a national award through the Red Cross for their work, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Well,
and 12 years later, I had the wedding of the second responder. It was just great.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that.
You're most welcome.
Well, you just keep on keeping on, sir.
Thank you for your good work, and you keep us informed.
I will. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's talk to Sherry in Santa Cruz. Hello, Sherry, and welcome to the program.
That was a really sweet story.
Wasn't it?
Yes, very. I wanted to ask you about a friend who has pleurisy, and it's after a couple of months of bronchitis,
mm-hmm.
and they're having difficulty getting the whatever is in the pleura out. Do you think that acupuncture would be an alternative treatment to the penicillin?
Is she also on some kind of anti-inflammatory, like ibuprofen
yes.
or Advil? Good, because that's really extremely helpful in pleurisy. Earlier, I was commenting on anti-inflammatory diet for arthritis, and all of those suggestions would be helpful for your friend from a natural medicine standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So omega-3 fatty acids and the anti-inflammatory foods or curcumin or turmeric extracts definitely would suggest that. Acupuncture, I would say, could be tried. When I think about how I would approach a case of pleurisy, it would depend on specific features of the individual case, but there'd be two things you could do. You could do a superficial Wei Qi treatment, which tends to hit the surfaces of things and is related to immunity. And I'd probably try that first, and then if that wasn't effective, run some energy along the lung channel and see what mm-hmm. could be done. So probably two or three visits as a trial to mm-hmm. see if you get some change. The good thing about something like pleurisy, which is pain when you breathe in, when you essentially move the lung against the inside lining of the chest so that the outside lining of the lung and the inside lining of the chest are rubbing against each other, they hurt. They're irritated and raw, and they grab and rub, and that's what pleurisy is. It's that pain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if it is indeed pleuritic pain and it's not misdiagnosed, and that's my concern, is that if you have chest wall pain from just lots of coughing, it can mimic pleurisy.
Mm-hmm.
So she may not actually have pleurisy. And
yeah, well, they did x-rays, so...
Yes, but you don't see pleurisy on x-rays.
Oh.
If she has fluid in there, you could see that. That would be called a pleural effusion, and that's a different thing. That is treated with antibiotics, and I probably wouldn't favor the use of acupuncture to treat a pleural effusion. I've been taught that those need to be dealt with rather aggressively.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye. We had a off-air question, which was, what do I think about a diabetic eating one cup of boiled brown rice a day? Well, I think that diabetic needs to check his or her blood sugar an hour after eating the rice. Hopefully they're not eating it all in one serving, but if that is how they're eating it, then yes, 1 hour later, check your blood sugar. If it's 150, I don't have a problem with your eating it. If it's 200, I do. Simple test. In general, brown rice is not that much better than white rice for diabetics. Just a little commentary on healthy eating, okay? People say, well, I have a healthy diet. You know, I eat whole wheat. Well, whole wheat is healthier than white flour because it contains the B vitamins that are present in the bran. But once you take wheat berries and you grind them up and turn them into dust, they are a high glycemic index food, so they will raise blood sugar in a diabetic, even though they're quote-unquote healthy. And it's very important to understand that a healthy diet needs to be considered in context. The healthy diet for a 2-year-old is not the healthy diet for a 62-year-old with a heart condition. There's a big difference in how you would feed those two individuals a healthy diet. Let's go to Sarah in Live Oak. Hello, Sarah. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question about light therapy.
Go ahead.
For seasonal affective disorder. I know you've addressed, I've heard you talk about the use of the tanning beds, which won't work for me, but I keep thinking about ordering one of those light boxes. And I have so many questions about it. Number one, sometimes they talk about you need the light to come through your eyes, your open eyes.
Okay, let me just clarify. Are we talking about light therapy for treatment of seasonal affective disorder? Are we talking about vitamin D?
Okay, that's my question.
Okay.
Yeah, because for depression, vitamin D is helpful. And also light is helpful. Well, the light creates the vitamin D if you get it on your skin.
Well, the natural phenomenon, let's talk about the natural phenomenon, is that in the winter, days get shorter, our vitamin D levels drop, and there's less available light to hit the back of the eyeball, the retina, and do things that stimulate the brain. The pineal gland, melatonin, gets other neurotransmitters get hooked into this. It's a complicated dynamic. Mm-hmm. Some people have a genetic deficit, let's call it a biochemical phenotypic deficit, such that when they don't get enough light in the wintertime, they develop depression, and that's called seasonal affective disorder, and it's a real thing. And there are light cases and heavy cases of it. Now, research has been done looking at just supplementing with high-dose vitamin D, and we're talking about 5,000, 10,000 units a day during the winter, and it has a statistically significant effect improving depression in people with seasonal affective disorder. So you could get the vitamin D from a tanning bed, or you could take it as a pill, and presumably they would be equivalent. Mm-hmm. Now, vitamin D aside, the effect of that light, ultraviolet light, hitting the back of the eye has effects on the brain that benefit seasonal affective disorder. And this is outside of the vitamin D aspect of it. That's where those light boxes come from. And the light boxes do work, you know, placebo studies, but you have to get strong enough light. Most of them are not, they're marginal in terms of the amount of light that they can put into a light box. It's nothing like what the sun is putting out. So you have to spend half an hour every morning in front of the light boxes to really get the benefit. That's hard to do as a placebo, although they have done placebo studies looking at the strength of the light, and there is definitely a threshold effect. And I'm trying to remember, and I am not certain. I believe it that the sweet spot is about 90,000 lux or lumens, 90,000 lumens, I think, is where you start to see the psychological benefit in the studies on seasonal affective disorder. And some boxes don't produce even nearly that much light and probably are just a placebo.
I wonder if you're right about that 90,000, because right here on the boxes that I've been studying, like the Apollo box, it's 10,000 lux.
Yeah, you have to go to the literature.
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer. I'm really reasonably good about remembering stuff, but that one I know I don't have the number.
Yeah, that would be easy to...
And that would be easy to go to Google Scholar and, you know, light therapy for depression, and the paper should pop right up to the top of the top of the heap that way.
Yeah.
By the way, for people who are looking up stuff, the Google does have a Scholar beta site which only gives you published articles. Nobody's selling anything can get on that site.
So you go to Scholar Data?
Scholar.google.com, I think.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Charlie went online and found a light therapy. The placebo was 100 lux and the active strength was 10,000 lux. So to our previous caller about light boxes, the light box that she mentioned that was 9,000 lux is definitely getting into the ballpark. And if Charlie found that article, I'm sure you can find it too. As I recall, duration is on the order of a half an hour every morning to get an effect for seasonal affective disorder. And let's go to Susan in Monterey. Hello, Susan, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn. Thank you for the program. I just have a question of your opinion. Do you think that these water filters, charcoal filters, you think they really serve a real purpose? I mean, do you advise them?
They are a cosmetic, and cosmetics are good. I love cosmetics, wear them every day. And they, in other words, I improve my appearance, and that's fine. The charcoal filters improve the taste of the water. A lot of water gets purified with chlorine. It, you know, there's various other trace compounds in it that change its taste or give it an odor. Charcoal takes all of that out. It doesn't really help with bacterial contamination. It doesn't really help with organic pollutants. If you want to get rid of bacteria, you need a micropore filter, something really, 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 really small that will filter out the bacteria and viruses and protozoans. And if you are trying to get rid of things like nitrates or persistent organic pollutants that might be leaching into the water, dioxin, any of the PCB compounds, for that you need reverse osmosis, which is a $500 to $1,000 filter that you install under the sink in your kitchen usually, and it has a little extra tap that comes up. RO systems definitely clean the water. The problem with them is they are wasteful. They're both energy wasteful and they use a lot of water. So I sort of feel a little bit of an eco criminal when I tell people to install RO systems, but then I'm a speciesist, meaning that humans come first in my view. So if you are a person who has special needs, I will tell you to get an RO system. If you can't handle pesticides or you're environmentally sensitive, that's what you need.
Well, I appreciate that. Now, just one more quick question. I can't afford that.
Right.
So would you advise that I just buy bottled water? And if I do buy bottled water, what should I look for? I'm told that some of them are just
tap water.
Tap water.
Well, I don't advise buying bottled water because it's inferior to tap water in most settings. Are you on a well or are you on a municipal water supply?
No, I live in an apartment.
All right, so you're on a municipal water supply. You're better off with just the tap water, and if you don't like the taste or smell of the tap water, run it through a charcoal filter.
Okay.
From a health standpoint, the bottled waters are inferior.
Well, I appreciate that, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Besides which, if you're on a fixed income, they're cheaper. You're already paying for it. Let's talk to Mike in Soquel. Hello, Mike, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
I just have a quick question about skin infections. A couple months back, I had kind of cut myself just on my upper lip when I was shaving. And ever since then, it's sort of come back as a sort of an intermittent, recurrent, sort of a minor infection, sort of like a pimple that's more aggressive. It's about a half an inch away from the side of my nose. And it doesn't really, it just sort of gets sort of red, but it doesn't ever really come to a white head or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it sticks around for a couple days and then it goes away. So I'm sort of concerned about its recurrence in the same location and wondering what can be done.
And you shave every day. How are you using an electric razor? Are you using disposables? And if so, how often do you replace the disposable razor?
I actually use a razor that has a blade in it that I replace every couple weeks.
Okay. So one problem may be that you're contaminating yourself with the razor. That is a possibility. When you cut yourself, you likely inoculated some bacteria fairly deep, and that is, you're having an arm wrestling contest with a small nidus of bacteria. So when it goes down, it doesn't completely eradicate, and then it comes back. And I'm presuming the cycle time on it, you know, you have it for 3 or 4 days, and then it goes down almost all the way back to normal, maybe all the way back to normal, and then within a couple of weeks, it's back up, flared again. Is that about the right time frame?
That's right.
Yeah, so I think you're arm wrestling but not winning the battle. So it's kind of like the Balkans, you know, that they come back after a generation and make war on you again. So what do you do about this? You probably are going to need at least topical antibiotics, if not oral antibiotics, to get rid of this once and for all.
So I have a tube of Bactroban.
Good. And were you ever diagnosed with methicillin-resistant Staph aureus?
No, I wasn't, but I think I was given it basically as a precautionary measure.
I would go ahead and treat my nose every night, inside my nostrils every night for a month.
For a month?
Yeah, every night. Okay. Just a little bit, but every night. And go after that area, you know, rubbing vigorously every day as well while you're at it.
Oh, so rubbing that ointment in really vigorously?
Yeah, rub hard. When you rub skin hard, you break open the little Velcro desmosomes, they're called, that hold the skin cells together. And for a brief moment there, you can get things to penetrate more deeply. So ultrasound will work, but just physical rubbing for maybe 30 seconds will get stuff to penetrate quite a bit deeper than if you just put it on the surface and let it soak in.
Okay. And then just once a night for a month in my nose.
Right, right. And then rubbing that. And then if after that month you're still getting recurrences, I would go with oral antibiotics, some, maybe some doxycycline and rifampin or something like that. But you'd need to go to a doctor and get it looked at.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You are welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Lucia in Hollister. Hello. You're on the air.
Hi, it's Lucia.
Excuse me?
I'm calling. Some time ago, you had told another listener about how to test the quality of calcium.
Right.
And you said to put it in vinegar, and it should dissolve within the first 15 minutes.
Right.
And so I haven't been able to find one that dissolves in the first 15 minutes.
Have you pushed on it with your finger? Because it may be that it doesn't dissolve into powder, but it, as soon as you hit it mechanically, it goes poof, and that would be all right.
Oh, okay. No, I haven't.
Yeah, because that's part of the vinegar test is you need to push on it a little bit, not real hard, but it should kind of crush or mush after the vinegar has dissolved the surface coating. Just stick your finger on it and push
it. Push it during the process or after the 15 minutes?
After 15 minutes, if you push on it and it's still hard as a rock, that's probably not going to dissolve well in you.
Okay, okay. Well, my other question is, are you allowed to recommend brands on your show?
I'm pretty much allowed to do anything. I wouldn't recommend a brand if I was receiving money from them, but since I'm not receiving money from anybody... Right, so I use a product, a magnesium calcium powder by Pure Encapsulations that is mixed with water, and it's kind of lemony tasting. I tend to just add it to a cup of tea, and that's how I get my calcium. There's a good product called Ionic Fizz. It's a little expensive.
Ionic Fizz?
It's a little expensive. It's very heavily online marketed, but one of my patients brought it in, and it's, you know, raspberry tasting, and it's a little bit fizzy, and it has good amounts of calcium and magnesium in a very highly absorbable salt. So those are good brands. Pure Encapsulations and a product called Ionic Fizz.
Okay. I mean, is that something that they sell at all health food stores, I would imagine?
Couldn't tell you. I don't really go to health food stores that often. I do most of my health food shopping online, at least as far as products are concerned. I don't keep track of what's on the shelves.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, and then I have another question. When I went to Step of Life and then I bought Chinese herbs, they all have the Prep 65 warning, and the store manager said that that's a requirement that they have to do for all of them, and that's basically saying that you could get cancer from taking, or you know, organic stuff.
Oh, really? Okay. That's kind of scary.
Do you know anything about that?
Well, whenever you get some sort of statutory thing that says you have to label it, I'm not quite sure how that Prop 65 thing happened or exactly what it says. So I'll have to take the fifth. I don't know enough about it to comment. I'll endeavor to find out, however, and talk about it on a future show.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Prop 65, just noting that down so I remember. Let's go to... a very interesting story. This one is about oxytocin, and it's not what you'd expect. Oxytocin's been described as the hormone of love. It's a chemical released by the hypothalamus. It gives rat mothers the urge to nurse their pups. It makes people trust each other. It's when a woman breastfeeds, she releases oxytocin and literally falls in love with her baby and vice versa. This study was very cleverly designed, and it was looking at the effect of oxytocin on trust, because the researcher, Dr. Karsten K.W. de Drew, who's a psychologist in Amsterdam, thought, you know, I'm having trouble with this from an evolutionary standpoint. Trust is tricky. If you trust too much, you're not going to survive. You're going to get eaten. So there has to be some sort of biological adaptation that allows oxytocin to improve survival, not reduce it. He did experiments that showed that if you give people oxytocin, they are more likely to favor their kinship group or their in-group. And he did this very cleverly. Recently in science, people have been doing studies where they will flash you a picture and a word, and you're supposed to match the picture and the word. And it's very rapidly. It's a time test. And it picks up unconscious associations and unconscious biases because you're working so quickly, you don't have time to edit. So using a similar technique, they would have you, let's, for example, the most famous study that was done in the United States is you have a picture of a black man, you have a picture of a white man, then you have words. Then the words might be things like evil, dirty, kind, clean, and you flash the pictures simultaneously with the words and have the person say if they're the same or different, and people will make mistakes or they'll be slower when they have an unconscious bias because they're fighting their own bias. They know that black is not dirty, but deep down in the subconscious, that message has not, that is a subconscious meme, if you will. It's in there and it's got overlays and overlays of civilization over it, but it's still in there enough to slow you down a millisecond that can be measured by a computer. In this search, they weren't doing African American and Caucasian American. They were doing Dutch citizens, having them compare Muslims and Germans. They would use names that were either Muslim or German and ask questions about these high value words like, you know, dirty, bad, dishonest, evil versus good, honest, trustworthy, and measure the time that takes the person to press the key. And what they found was the people who were not given the oxytocin tended to be less prejudiced against the outgroup. Once they were given a dose of oxytocin and it was allowed to take effect, they would actually tend to have a more negative view of the outgroup. So in the case of the Dutch, they were more negative about the Muslims and the Muslim names when they'd been given the love, trust hormone, which is very counterintuitive. But the way to think about it is that the oxytocin makes you favor those close to you. It makes you favor your in-group, the group that you self-identify with, and it makes you more likely to favor that group than if you don't have oxytocin. And, you know, when I think about mother love and, you know, nursing and nurturing and tribes of humans roaming the savannah, it all kind of makes sense. But it also speaks to something I think that's been playing on my mind a lot lately, which is the idea that the difference between people at the right end of the political spectrum and people at the left end of the political spectrum may to a certain extent be how large they frame their in-group as. If you frame your in-group as small, your clan, your village, I think you tend to have a more politically conservative view, at least on social issues, possibly also on military issues. I'm guessing that will be true. On the other hand, if you see, you know, if you follow the John Donne philosophy that, you know, every man's death diminishes me, then, you know, you actually care what's going on in Tanzania or Sudan because you do feel intimately connected with that group. And that will tend to make you different politically. I wonder what happens if you give oxytocin to people on the left. That would be an interesting study. I bet it makes them more conservative. So let's go to our next caller, and that is Anne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anne, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, and thank you for this wonderful public service that you're doing. I have a problem with when I take flax oil or fish oil. I bruise. Now, I know it's supposed to do the opposite, but I've done an experiment with myself, and I bruise when I take it.
All right, so I would first comment that you shouldn't take it if it's making you bruise.
Okay.
Now, you may be a person who has a very high tendency to bleed in the first place. You may be missing a protein like protein C or protein S, mm-hmm. or have anti-latent factor or antithrombin 3, all sorts of these known biochemical hereditary abnormalities that are genetic will cause a person to bleed more readily. And the last thing that person needs is blood thinning.
Right.
Now, some of these we can test for and some of them we can't.
Well, I had some surgery a few years ago and I was tested and nothing really came up.
But that doesn't mean you don't have a bleeding tendency. It means you don't have a bleeding tendency we can identify.
Okay. And I really need the flax oil and the fish oil for my osteoarthritis and other things for my hair, my skin, and all that. So any suggestions?
I think that the first thing that I would do is look at capillary fragility. Are you bruising all over your body or just on your arms?
All over.
All over? Okay.
All over. I mean my arms, my legs. If I bang into something, if I touch something a little too hard, I bruise.
Okay.
And I remember you talking about topical vitamin K at one point.
Right, but that, I think, in your case, you'd have to be bathing in it. So
yeah, I think you're right.
That wouldn't necessarily solve the problem. This is a tough one. I think you will have to use the curcuminoids. I think you'll have to go after other types of anti-inflammatory.
What's the word you used?
Things like turmeric.
Oh, turmeric.
And there are other anti-inflammatories. There's pine, something that's like made with pine, picogynol.
Mm-hmm. I've taken that. It's grapeseed.
So there's a number of plant anti-inflammatories that might help with your arthritis that don't have the blood thinning properties. But I would be concerned that you might be setting yourself up for injury. Now, is it a big deal?
No.
No. And you could put up with the bruising. The problem is you're probably at an increased risk if you're in a traumatic situation or if you have surgery. So you could do the flaxseed or the omega-3 and then stop for 2 weeks before any operation. Of course, if you get in a car accident, then you're going to have more injury.
So perhaps I should see if I can get tested for the protein C and the protein...
It's called a thrombophilia panel, but the problem is, as I said, the panel does not identify all of the possible mutations. So if you have a positive result, it tells you for sure you have it, but a negative result doesn't tell you that you don't have one. And if you bruise easily, of course, get your vitamin C level checked.
Yeah, my vitamin C. I take a lot of vitamin C.
Okay, because that...
I take at least 3,000 units of it a day.
Right, and you've had a body check, red cell vitamin C level, so you know you're actually absorbing it.
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, well, this is very interesting. And so the grape seed, which is, I know what you're talking about, the pine and the turmeric, and to have this thrombo panel might be of some help.
Yeah, thrombophilia. No, I'm sorry, that's wrong. I'm sorry. No, the protein C and I've got it backwards. The protein C and protein S would make you clot more. The things that we would worry about would be factor deficiencies. Like factor 10, factor 7. There are, 15 different proteins involved in forming a blood clot.
Okay.
Plus there's platelets. So you could also look at platelet function testing.
Mm-hmm.
And you should look at factor testing.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
I think we have time for one quick call, and that is Andrea in Santa Cruz. Hello, Andrea.
Yeah, good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I just wanted to let you know how much I appreciated. A few times ago, you spoke to someone who had dizziness from one ear, something dysfunction. And briefly, you mentioned the word tinnitus, and I have been dealing with tinnitus for years. It's a really deep drone that I hear. And I've tried acupuncture and homeopathy. Homeopathy actually worked some, but then, can never have coffee, and it didn't really do the trick.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked up the Epley procedure, I think you called it.
Yes.
Online, and I really looked at all the little video clips that they had, and I found one where you can do it yourself. And I have done it, and I'm free of it.
Excellent.
And I just wanted people to know, because there are a lot of people who suffer from tinnitus. And
absolutely.
It's so annoying.
It is. Well, I am very excited to hear that that actually worked for that problem, because...
Yeah, I did it twice. I did it once, it worked immediately, and then it came back, I did it one more time, and I haven't had it since.
That's super. All right. Well, we will definitely pass that along. Yeah. And if you would not mind sending me the link, just find that link to that video, and then... go to AskDrDawn.com to our contact us and paste it into the contact box, I'd really appreciate it.
Okay, I will try to find it again. I printed it out, but I will try and find it again and send it to you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for your program.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. Got time, I think, for one last email. This one is from Gabriel in Ireland, and Gabriel writes, I'll spare you the compliments. I'm skipping to the cutting to the chase here. On a recent trip to the U.S., my girlfriend bought me a device called AccuLife Therapy Deluxe from an in-flight magazine. It says it's an electroacupuncture device that's FDA approved. I'm a naturopathic physician and appreciate the health benefits of acupuncture, but know nothing about the practice of this model. Not sure if this machine is safe and beneficial, or is it a gimmick? First thing, Gabriel, is that it actually is a legitimate acupuncture device. It has a Wheatstone bridge in it for those electronic people out there, and it allows you to identify areas of low skin resistance, which correlates quite highly with acupuncture points. The stimulator is a standard speed. It's I believe a 10 hertz stimulator if it's the device I'm thinking of, and that's a little bit of a compromise. Generally, when we're doing electroacupuncture, we will vary the speed depending on the effect. In other words, a rapid speed tends to be more dispersing and numbing. A slow speed tends to be more nourishing and tonifying. It's like a one-size-fits-all on something that isn't one-size-fits-all. To use it for general health, I think, is fine. You could be well advised to treat perhaps the stomach 36 point every morning as a tonic. You aren't going to hurt yourself that way. Could you mess up your chi if you used the wrong point, did the exact opposite of what you should do? Yeah, you might. Might make yourself feel bad for a couple of hours. I doubt you could do yourself any serious harm or significantly muddle yourself. It's hard to do long-term serious harm with acupuncture. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.